Hi, this is Bill Hoag.
Hi, Bill. This is Ron Blade.
Oh, thanks for being on, Ron. How are you today?
Just fine.
I see from your peer profiles that you've been in higher education for 39 years, so fill us in a little bit on that.
Yes, be glad to. I have been in a leadership role, CIOs, at three different community colleges over those 39 years. I started out in a small community college in Freeport, Illinois, Highland Community College. After a couple of years, I moved up to a mid-size community college, Joliet, in Illinois. And then I've been was there about 12 years. And then the last 25 years, I've been at the largest community college in the country and one of the largest educational systems in the country, the Maricopa Community Colleges. And my role has been Vice Chancellor of Information Technologies. So I've kind of been dedicated to the community college movement and have had technology leadership in all of those. In some ways, you can say I've had the same job for 39 years. I've been a CIO at these different places. However, it certainly was a kind of a graduated environment in types and sizes of colleges through time.
So you must have started around the mid-1960s or so?
That's correct. I actually started, I was an industrial programmer for 1 year, started in 1966, went to my first college gig in 1967. So my career has spanned the punch card era through the mainframes and mini computers and personal computers, microcomputers, all the way up to now mobile computing and wireless computing and all those things are going on now. So I've covered multiple generations of technology. And I actually was very privileged to start in community colleges when they were all starting in the middle 60s also. So I got on the ground floor of two major movements, which I'm very pleased about, and that was the community college movement in America and the computer revolution in America. And so I kind of parlayed both of them into, in my opinion, a very good career, and I've enjoyed it all entire time.
You're one of those rare and fortunate individuals who stayed professionally active in parts of five decades.
Yes, and well, yeah, I'm still going too a little bit. You know, I am reducing it my workload and have responsibility. I am now a consultant to one of our colleges at Paradise Valley. I'm no longer the Vice Chancellor of Information Technologies. I left that position in early January. So I am now working half-time out at this college as a technology consultant to them.
And presumably you have a little bit more time to reflect, which is what this conversation is all about. In particular, for those of us who are still in the hot seat as CIOs, regardless of our age and our time in service, I'll speak for myself and I'm sure for David as well. We always appreciate hearing perspectives of other experienced CIOs. And as we put together our chapter as a contribution to the book that EDUCAUSE is going to publish, our chapter about career development, we focused a lot of our attention and energy not only on people who are leaders now, but who aspire to be leaders in the years ahead. So reflect, if you would, a little bit using the framework I offered or anything else that you'd care to talk about on advice or counsel or experience or anecdotes or anything that pleases you related to your career.
Okay, there's a few anecdotes. I actually got started in it back in the middle 60s by accident. Went to a management training program at that company, and the day I walked in to begin that, a computer programmer walked out. And this was the first days of the IBM 360. And so it was just by pure coincidence I ended up in it. And I kind of, after a period of time, and actually I tell the story that about 6 months later at this company, the largest snowstorm in history of Chicago occurred, and we were stranded in downtown Chicago at the IBM building, and we actually worked all weekend. Now, back in those days, it was very difficult to test out programs you had written. In fact, we waited weeks sometimes between running because there just wasn't any computer resources available. But because we were the only ones in the IBM Center, we had all this weekend, and all of a sudden I found kind of my passion for computing that weekend because of a snowstorm. So there's two major coincidences. I wasn't real interested before then, but that got me started. Then I had an opportunity to go to community college, and at the time I had 1 year of experience and a master's degree, which was still was unheard of in that time. Now there's obviously tens of thousands of people qualified like that, but in 1966, there were very few of us. And so even though I was very young, I got the head job at a startup community college and been there ever since. So it really didn't start by accident, but then once I got into it, I never chose to stick my nose and look for other jobs. I love the community colleges. I love the technology part of it. You know, I have probably interviewed for fewer jobs than any person around. I mean, I've interviewed for like four or five jobs in my entire career, and the last 39 years, only two of them. So I've been very fortunate to have, in that regard.
It struck me as you were talking just a moment ago that because you've had the benefit of having long stints in three places, as I recall, you've probably had an opportunity to develop some significant relationships within those institutions as well as relationships in the broader IT community regionally and nationally. Could you talk a little bit about any mentoring opportunities that you've had either as mentor or earlier in your career having someone sort of take you under their wing?
Yes, and it really turned out to be an advantage in my early part of my career when I was starting out at these community colleges. You know, there was no other computer person there to mentor me, but fortunately there were some very capable vice presidents of instruction or deans of instruction, whatever you want to call them at the time, or vice president level people who I related to and worked with, and they taught me, and they gave me always the bigger picture. So I didn't have anybody mentoring me on specific technology issues, but I did have people mentoring me on the bigger picture of the purpose of the community college or college, higher education, and that actually proved to be more beneficial than some technical skill sets that I may have been taught. However, and then when I went to Maricopa, I was for a long time. I had the same boss for a period of 22 years, and that was Paul Elsner, a very renowned visionary chancellor of our system. And that proved to be very good, too, because, again, he saw not only the big picture, he saw over the horizon, and that always led me to think about those kind of things more than wallowing in the details. So I'm very pleased that I had those kind of mentors rather than a more traditional type of mentoring. In regard to the other type of mentors, I've been very involved in EDUCAUSE and its predecessors before then, and I consider my friendships, my professional and personal relationships of the people I've met through EDUCAUSE being extremely beneficial too. So they're not exactly mentoring, but they certainly are collaborative partners and really helpful. So one of the great treasures in this business has been that the friendships I've made on a professional level with many of the people in higher education, IT, that's been very useful. And I call them on the phone and down through the years and what's happening here and there and what should I do here and there. And so that's been a terrific asset.
Ron, what about mentoring others, developing professionals and leaders who have worked for you?
Well, as I said, I grew small departments. I came into big departments, and so I've had any number of people were assigned to me as I was their mentor through special programs. So I have mentored any number of people through time under, there's a women's program, there's a young administrators program, there's any number of things that we've had where people have chosen me. So yes, I have certainly done that with younger staff, and I've always been proud that a lot of people decided to pick me. My style was friendly enough and consultative enough that a lot of these younger people seem to relate to me.
Do you maintain contacts and relationships and friendships with a lot of those people today?
Yes, many of them are still in this organization, and those who aren't, I certainly get contacts and emails or say hi to them. It's really great when you go to an EDUCAUSE conference and you see somebody who worked for you years ago and as a young puppy and now is a management role. So, yeah, I certainly do.
You mentioned a little bit earlier in the conversation that back in the day, when you were getting your career start, you were unusually well qualified.
Yeah.
your degrees relative to some of the other people who were working in the field. And certainly you have seen lots of evolution in what's expected of a vice chancellor, for example, or a CIO. Could you reflect a little bit on what some of those changes have been over the years and what you might see for the future?
Well, it's certainly more comprehensive in the complexities. IT went from kind of a backroom shop, although we had always, tried to support instruction best we could, to being, mainstream now. Although I was always fortunate to be at colleges that supported technology, and so it was, and I say it's backroom, it wasn't quite that bad. It was always still a pretty good place to be. So it's certainly a much bigger business than when I started, and with that brings complexity and people and technologies and politics. The skill set needed today, of course, is I still think pretty much the same as back then, however, and that the really important things in leadership are the soft side of leadership, not the technical side of it. So even though we've got more complicated, more hardware, I still think the key to success for anybody is what they do on a personal level. I start out with some things like, I think a key ingredient for leadership is ethical, the ethical dimension, and being a person that others can trust, and particularly subordinates and peers. And so you've got to be of the strongest ethics. One of the concerns I have is some people who don't trust their subordinates enough. And I think one of the technologies that's bad, actually working against being a good leader, is our communication technologies, whether it be wireless cell phones or be email systems. I see a great temptation of people to be too connected to their subordinates and the work back. Now, I was at a Microsoft Advisory Committee meeting last week in Seattle, and there were 25 of us there, and during any two-day session, any hour of the day, the 20 of the 25 CIOs had their laptops open and doing email back home. Now, I think there's a real problem with that. Not only I'm discourteous to the guy or the people making the presentations, but also the fact that you're not trusting the people back home to do the carry on with the work. And there's some email needs to be done, but this continuous day after day, hour after hour, and knowing my type of emails I got, the 90% of them are trivial, and or even higher, and so to be trivializing communications back home, I think is a real problem, and it shows a lack of trust in subordinates to solve the problem back home. So I'd say one thing I would say that's worked against being a good leader is the communication technologies. On one hand, it's bragged about how we can solve problems, we can do things from any number of places, but there's a dark side to that, and that's the trust argument.
Ron, let me follow up on that. It's an excellent point, and ask you another question along those lines. What kinds of characteristics do you see in the people who report to you that tell you that you can trust them, that make you want to turn over the reins to them and have faith in what they're going to do?
They come to you with a personality style that is not full of I's, but more we's, or us, or them, or, them in a positive way. They're not caught up on their individual ego. They're more into, we're in it together, this is a team, everybody's working on this as a project or as a group. Just by listening to the kinds of words they use and the personal pronouns, tells me a lot about an individual and the trust that might be involved. And of course, in certain behaviors that are demonstrated through time and what they say, it proves to be the reality of it. They oversold something, they over-glamorized something, or they over-covered up something. Those are recognizables, who kind of statements a person can make.
you mentioned a little bit earlier that some of the people that you were closely associated with and perhaps mentored in years past, I think you referred to them back when they were young pups.
Yeah.
And now they're in responsible management positions, either as part of your current institution or elsewhere in higher education or perhaps in other economic sectors. Are there any sort of common characteristics that you might point to? And this is closely related to David's question. Are there common characteristics that you think stand out among that group of people who've gone on to leadership positions on their own as opposed to people who have not?
Yes, and there's a real dividing line amongst people, and it's, are you going to be a technology wizard or are you going to be a leader? Most of the time, those are kind of exclusive. You can get in love with the technology, and you can have a very important and successful life, you know, solving deep technical problems. But the real common denominator is you're willing to not get trapped into the allure of technology, but being willing to deal with politics and people and the broader picture. And so I think the biggest dividing line amongst the young pups are out there, those who have chosen technology and want to get deep in technology, that's fine. But if you want to be a management, a CIO, a leader, you got to be less, be more willing to give up on some of your time you spend in technology and spend some of that time on the communications, people relationships, the politics, all those kind of things.
Any suggestions that you might have about, let's say that some of our audience members for this interview are people who are on the cusp of that kind of a career decision. Any suggestions that you might offer on how to make a decision that's good for each of those people as individuals? What are some of the factors in your own life, perhaps, or that you've observed in others that led to a management or leadership track as opposed to continuing to understand the technology more deeply?
It's kind of a real personal self-assessment. I would advise people who are thinking about leadership to make certain they're on some of the college-wide committees and understand what the college is all about, what its purpose, its mission, understand how people relate to each other. And if you get very upset with people and the politics of it, then it's not going to be the place for you. But look to the organization. Just get involved in things. Attend different training sessions or workshops or presentations or speeches or a multitude of things that even are not related directly to technology but to the running of the institution or the educating the students and see how they click with you. And if that does click with you, then maybe then you have the potential for being a broader-based person and a leader, and also how your quotients are being able to deal with people. I think people relationships is really the important part of it here, and if people irritate you, if you don't get along with people, if you want to do everything yourself without trusting people to do it and delegating, then you need to be the deep inside person rather than the broad person. See if you're interested in the organization and its mission and its role, and then see if you can work with people.
As you've rolled along through your career, are there any particular types of information, books you've read, management or leadership theories? I'm thinking here, you know, some people are big devotees, for example, of Peter Drucker.
Yes.
Other people feel like they don't subscribe to any particular management approach. Anything that you've picked up along the way that you found to be useful as a guidepost or set of guideposts for you?
Well, I got really caught up in the quality movement and then the reengineering movement of the early 90s, and so I read a lot of those books. I read many of the management books, and they were very popular in the early 90s, late 80s. From Peters to Drucker, I got caught up in Learning Organization with Peter Senge, and I still respect all those works, by the way. So there has been good things. I don't know. I think it may have dried out a little bit lately. Jim Collins' Good to Great is a terrific book I'd recommend to anybody. But a very good source still is EDUCAUSE materials. I would recommend that the first place you stop is the EDUCAUSE publications and EDUCAUSE website and all the different components there. So that's the most important step to be aware of. Read those.
Ron, I'm trying to think of the best way to ask this, but how much of a role do you think the crucible sort of a concept plays? You know, the Bennis and Thomas and talking about tempering people through challenges and sometimes adversity and things like that in terms of their preparation for leadership. In your mind, how much of an issue is that?
Yeah, that's important. Now, that's another factor. Resilience is a word I would use. Every one of us, and maybe it's every other day, make bad decisions or failures in this business. So we've all bought the wrong software product. We've all messed up an implementation. We've all done whatever or even out. None of our fault, but the hardware goes south on us or the software goes south on us or the company went bankrupt. So, you know, anybody who's been in this business has got a long line of stories to be told of things that didn't work out as you have put in software. So resilience, be able to bounce back, is a key ingredient. And understand that it's happened. And unfortunately, the batting average is pretty high, I think, what we do in this business that haven't really worked out for whatever reason. And the person who's going to succeed is those who can absolutely do that and understand that it's not the end of the world and not go into a shell, not go into whatever cause a lot of problems. Again, a great piece of advice, as I said, my best mentor perhaps was the chancellor here for a long time. He said he always lived in the philosophy that a bad decision is better than no decision. And so he encouraged us to make risky decisions in buying a product or implementing a system and that we wouldn't be fired if it didn't work out. And that's a pretty good viewpoint to have. But yeah, absolutely. This batting, I mean, I don't know what the batting average would be, but even for the most successful CIO in this country, there's a substantial percent of things don't work out for all of us.
Ron, coming back to that concept of resilience for a second, and maybe a close cousin of resilience is finding balance in your life. Any insights that you might be willing to share about how you personally have managed in a career that spans the length yours has to maintain that resiliency and be able to stay balanced in your personal and professional pursuits?
Well, I would put this at the top of the list. I start out with ethical dimension, but maybe the number one dimension is work-life balance. And again, I've been very fortunate in having a family situation that's been exemplary, living in conditions that are wonderful. So maybe I haven't had real personal setbacks. But I still believe the most important thing is understanding that balance between your work and your life and keeping that proper perspective, giving time to your family of whatever form it's in, giving time to your own personal recreation and health is there. Equally and not having to work day and night and getting worked up about the job. So you got to be able to really partition your life and maintain a balance. I gave a speech at the EDUCAUSE conference in Orlando in October, and I had one slide and talked a little bit about work-life balance. And in all the people's questions and all of that, that was the single thing that resonated most with the audience. Of how to do that. Please help us with that. Hey, that's the greatest thing I've ever heard. I even had a woman come up to me just 2-3 weeks ago who I didn't know and remembered my exact words on that topic who was in the audience and was so pleased that I had brought that issue up. And so that made my day when somebody out of the blue comes up to me and talked about how I acknowledge the importance of that. So yeah, that may be the starting point. And again, there's some things out of people's control with health and with family circumstances that don't work out for them, and that's makes it a lot tougher than for some of the rest of us who've been very blessed.
Are there particular guiding principles or aphorisms or anything of that nature that you have relied on consistently over your career and have stood the test of time, particularly those things that have helped you to develop what has been an exemplary career?
Well, I'd be very proud that I think most would say, what a nice guy, what a sincere guy. Those would be probably my trademarks. Things that I say to them, phrases I've used this phrase, nobleness of the cause, meaning that what we do in higher education is not putting money in some shareholder's back pocket, but we're helping people. And so even though we are in technology, our mission is wonderful. We're in the business of helping people. And so that's what's so good about working in colleges or education in general. So I always talked about that, that this is just not a job where we're coding lines of JavaScript or something like that, but it's we have a greater mission in life than making programs work, and that is, you know, serving students. And I think that whole issue of who we're here for, the students, is another kind of a theme I've always had, and a lot of people would introduce me as such, that we're student. I am student-oriented more than some other things. There's an article in the current EDUCAUSE review that I consider our roles as IT leaders to be either as plumbers, gardeners, or alchemists. And actually, we're all of them, and we don't, plumbers that are the folks who deal really with hard infrastructure and networks, CPUs, et cetera, software. Gardeners is where we go around planting seeds, hoping that, a project will sprout, or servicing a few interested faculty members and developing projects that way, and we all do that, find the heat seekers. But, the real role I see for us is as alchemists, where you mix a lot of things together and make gold out of this mixture of hardware, software, people. But the point I make is, what is the gold we're trying to make? It's just not better systems, but it is a gold that really strikes at what higher education should be about. Not necessarily what it is about today, but what it should be about. And a lot of that centers around improving student success. And so that's another phrase you'll see me using a lot about alchemy, that we mix things up, and not only mix them up, let's produce something that's worthwhile.
Ron, by your definition, how would you define student success?
Well, that's a wide range, and it's moving a person from one point A to point B that accomplished some objective. You know, it's most times it's thought of in degrees and certificates, but it's also, in some cases, simply an upgrade of a skill set. Some it's just being some life improvement we've given to them, a small sense of joy or satisfaction or accomplishment. So it's whole kinds of things, but it is a focus on the student is what we want to be about, and moving them along some scale of accomplishment. I think we get misled in higher education of certain mythologies we live by, and get caught up in degrees and certificates more than moving a person along some kind of accomplishment scale. That's a good question.
Well, it's actually one that we're wrestling with right now in terms of building a new building and a center for student success, and, you know, it depends on which constituency you ask. Of course, what is student success? So I was very curious about your perspective on that.
I have a real crusade that the best thing we can do for student success is not the old 1970s student success formulas, but the key to it is changing our schedules. Course scheduling is the biggest barrier to student success in our environment. The fixed multiple time per week class meeting time is works against our students. And so I've done a lot of research on that. And by moving to a blended hybrid environment, we could dramatically improve student success because we've reduced the probability that a life interruption will get in their way. The students we serve in community colleges are not captured. They all work. They all have family. They all have obligations. They all have things that go wrong in life. So by being more flexible, more convenient with them, we can serve them far better. And boy, that's a hard sell. We all believe that 16-week semesters and three times a week and come to campus kind of things are the only way to do it, Troy. But that's not the life our students lead. And so the sooner we realize that the old mythologies of higher ed don't work anymore for the vast, vast majority. Obviously, there's a select group of students who are residential. It can work for. But 87% of all students in America commute. And the minute you commute to your campus, you're in a different ballgame than traditional student services think about you. So my big soapbox is think scheduling, course scheduling first before you worry about counseling centers and advisement centers and all those things.
You're kind of a closet radical.
Oh, I'm more than that. I'm not in the closet.
It has been a real pleasure to listen to you. You know, and boy, I'm sitting here feeling like I've been the benefit of so much wisdom, and I mean that with absolute sincerity. If someone asks you, Ron, if you could tell someone, whatever you do, remember this one thing. Is there any one thing that you haven't mentioned to us already?
The one other thing I'd mention is I've seen a lot of our people get caught up on one agenda. And you need to have multiple agendas of leadership. That may mean multiple projects, you know, multiple skill sets, that. Too many people go down a certain track of being a, because technology gets you excited about one thing, and so they get all consumed about a one thing. So I'd say they have multiple agendas, be broad-based kind of thing would be another clue to success. And don't be narrowly focused on some issue.
Ron, you've been extremely generous with your time. David, do you have other questions that you would like to pose? Or
I don't think so.
Do you have other comments that you think we ought to, things that we should have asked you that we didn't?
No, this has been a delightful time. We don't have to end it. I've enjoyed this conversation and glad to be asked these kind of things. Sometimes these get into the old fart talk, old fart speech, reminiscing.
We'll probably edit that out, but go ahead.
Yeah.
No, we got to leave that in. That's,
okay, we'll leave it.
And Jack McCready, Berkeley, talks about that, how some of us who get on these podiums and talk about it, we get caught up in reminiscing too much. We kind of, the audience glazes over in that regard, but there's some wisdom by reminiscing, but we got to certainly fast forward to the future and build skill sets that lead us to new directions. But
well, Ron, as a good way to perhaps close our conversation, what's next for you? It sounds as though you're still active, you're still interested in being engaged. What do you see in your future over the next few years?
Well, as I said, I'm working half-time. We have a special retirement program at one of our colleges, and there'll be multiple projects I work on. The two projects I've been handed off this month to work on, they're about to buy a large library building that's right adjacent to the campus, that the new library building that the county is closing because there's no patrons to it. And we're going to buy it as an instructional space. So I'm encouraging them to think about hybrid or blended learning as make it a center for that. Again, back to my soapbox of flexible scheduling. And the other thing that's kind of on the agenda of the Maricopa Community Colleges is making that into a baccalaureate center. Not only community colleges will undoubtedly be offering baccalaureates within the next year or two or three, they also will be hosting other colleges at baccalaureate centers. So it'll be a combined four-year degrees that we offer and four-year degrees that other colleges offer. So that'll be a big business that we'll be growing into. Another fondness I've had is I did talk about is know the numbers, and I like numbers too. Despite all this talk about people, I also like numbers and statistics, and so I'm doing some business intelligence projects, perhaps with them, with SaaS products and so forth, to finally, for once and forever, get a college to make decisions upon information rather than the anecdotes. And we're very good at never having made a decision on realities or information yet, but maybe that'll change. And so I've always dabbled in looking at numbers in different ways. Again, even kind of out of the IT profession, I don't know, you may have heard of the top 25 courses kind of thing, that the bulk of enrollment and 50% in community colleges and a third in universities are in only 25 courses. Well, that all came from my original research, and now I'm on this life interruption issue is the big issue, that 65% of the reason our students don't complete these courses is because of life interruptions. Nothing to do with advisement, nothing to do with the quality of instruction, but it's just life gets them. And so I'm always into these research activities too, and trying to make decisions upon the realities, not the myths of higher education. So that's my life. I'm gonna play around with those ideas, and hopefully have a few soapboxes once in a while to say these things.
Well, I want to thank you for spending time with us today.
Absolutely.
I expect that this will be a record that people will want to refer to for many years in the future, and you're very gracious with your comments today.
Bill and David, I really thank you for the time. It's been a pleasure for me. We've got to raise up new people. The profession's at stake, and so anything that does any little bit to improve leadership in our profession, I'm right there with you.
Well, thank you again for
your time.
Thank
you so much.
Okay, guys. Thanks.
Thank you, Ron.
Ron, thanks a lot.
Have a good day.
Take care.
Bye.